Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
When we started this podcast, it felt like we had to figure everything out ourselves. Scripts, setups, filming schedules, logos. It was incredibly overwhelming and every day brought a new decision that needed an answer. And when you're starting with something new, it feels like your to-do list can keep growing every single day and it can begin to overrun your life. Finding the right tool that not only helps you out but simplifies everything can be a total game changer. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US. So they're working with household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands that are just getting started.
You can get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand style.
And accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography.
Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling.
And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing, returns, and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify.
Turn your big business idea into... with Shopify on your side.
Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan. Today, can reform weasel its way out of a Russian bribe scandal and allegations of Nigel Farage goose-stepping in the playground?
And a co-leadership model has been ruled out for your party. After endless public spats between Zara Sultana and Jeremy Corbyn, could this finally mean some peace?
But first...
we beat the forecasts this year and we will beat them again. Yeah! By boosting trade, not blocking it. By increasing investment, not cutting it. Yeah. By championing innovation, not stifling it. Yeah. By backing working people, not making them poorer. Yeah.
That's an exuberant Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, delivering what's been framed as a make-or-break second budget for the government. The challenge facing Reeves is the need to plug a black hole estimated to be between £20 and £30 billion and raise the funds to turn around crumbling public services, all while keeping taxes at an acceptable level.
Now, the run-up to the budget has been pretty chaotic and drawn out. Over the past 4 months, we've seen 13, yes, 13 different tax policies floated, leaked, denied and dropped. And all this has made it harder for Reeves to convince the markets and voters that she has it all under control, prompting speculation about her future and Keir Starmer's, whose leadership has recently come under fire.
Then it turned out that the leakiest budget in history was also leaked in full. Rachel Reeves' big reveals, many of which we did know about anyway, were mistakenly leaked early by the Office for Budget Responsibility, which published the details accidentally in an enormous cock-up whilst blaming a technical error. So we actually... helpfully for us, knew what was in the budget before she even stood up.
Yeah, Reeves opened her address discussing this. She seemed absolutely fuming. None of it adds to the sense that Labour has got things under control. So the question is, will Reeves' budget be enough to unite restless backbenchers? Will it please the markets? And will it make voters feel that Starmer and Reeves have a grip on all of this? So here to help us wrap our heads around it is political journalist and sometime host of Pod Save the UK. It's Zoe Grunewald.
Hello.
Hi, Zoe. Welcome back to PSUK. So what did you think of it? What did you think of Reeves' speech?
So I think it's probably done just enough to keep those fractious backbenchers at bay for a little bit.
Sure.
I think it was a budget designed to calm the market and quiet the backbenchers, not to radically change the country. And the problem is a lot of people would say that's actually the latter is what we need. But I think... if you're thinking about where this government is politically mm-hmm. and the dangers that they see immediately surrounding them, I think they've done just enough to keep those MPs on the left happy, some on the right happy, and crucially buy them more time until potentially May when we'll get the next pinch point with the election. So I think it's a political budget, I would say, rather than a kind of radical budget that is going to fundamentally upend our economy or improve our living standards.
So just some of the sort of background to this is that Rachel Reeves went into this facing a less bad situation than had been anticipated. So the OBR forecasts initial higher growth than was expected. So it's 1.5% instead of 1%. as always, when these things happen, it's always worth noting, boy, we can really feel that extra 0.5%. You walk around, the air's a bit cleaner, the birds are chirping a bit more musically. It's a real 0.5% difference in our quality of life. But then its forecast was also downgraded, which is obviously not great for Rachel Reeves' growth hopes. The headline figure in all of this is that there'll be £26 billion of tax rises by 2029 to 2030. Reeves has acknowledged that this is tough, but promises some reform, saying, I'm asking everyone to make a contribution, but I will ensure that the wealthiest contribute the most. So, Zoe, just in purely political terms at this stage, has she broken a manifesto commitment? Or has she got out of it on a technicality? Because the manifesto committed that there'd be no new taxes on working people. Technically, these tax rises come from a variety of sources. Some of changes to the council tax system, which is supposed to put pressure on wealthier households. But a lot of it, the bulk of it, comes from freezing income tax thresholds. Does that break a manifesto commitment, or have they got out of it on a technicality?
I think it kind of hardly matters to some extent, because what it is a budget that is essentially balancing the books on the back of ordinary people. You know, the 26 billion in extra tax, the lion's share of that is coming, as you say, Nish, from freezing personal tax thresholds and higher national insurance contributions on pensions. So, you know, you can argue, oh, we didn't technically break our manifesto commitment, but people are going to be pushed into those higher tax brands. They're going to see more of a disincentive to save for their pension. So we can argue over, oh, have they broken a manifesto commitment? That is important. But ultimately, what is happening here is, are working people going to feel that this Labour government has their interests at heart and are going to tax wealth over work? And I don't think this budget is reassuring in that regard.
Well, Rees did manage to pull one rabbit out of the hat. Here is the Chancellor.
Because I am tackling fraud and error in our welfare system, because I am cracking down on tax avoidance, because I am reforming gambling taxation, I can announce today, fully costed and fully funded, the removal of the two-child limit in full from April.
They've dragged their feet over lifting the child benefit cap for so long. I mean, at one point, Reform was even calling for it. So do you think Labour's going to get the credit for this?
I think you're right. They've dragged their feet. You know, they've already had MPs lose the whip over this. It has been a real source of tension in the party right from the very beginning. Mm. We shouldn't underplay the impact of removing the cap.
Right, yeah. Yes.
450,000 kids, some estimates say, could be lifted out of poverty. I mean, that is a great thing to do. But I think what is stinging about this is it just feels like something that could have been done or should have been done immediately when Labour came into government. Because who are the Labour Party for if not bringing kids out of poverty? It was in their manifesto. They want to continue bringing kids out of poverty. They're proud of the legacy they had previously on this. So I think it's frustrating for a lot of Labour MPs that this has been such a public spat. It's gone on for so long. They've seen colleagues lose the whip over it. And now it's been lifted. Are they going to get an apology? Is there going to be an acknowledgement of the campaigning that's been done? And I think that is the frustration. And I think it also rings to this image of this Labour government being one that is so obsessed with the technical details over any ideology or vision or, you know, feeling of what this country should be. I mean, a lot of Labour MPs feel that fundamentally it's just in Labour's DNA that they should be doing that kind of thing. It shouldn't be something that you have to spend a year trying to make balancing the books work. So they should get credit for it having this impact on children in poverty, of course. But I think the way it's been handled and how long it's been dragged out is going to dampen that quite a bit.
Let's just talk about younger generations and how they might feel about this budget. So there's growing concern that current tax and spending policies help pensioners, but are unfair on younger generations. High taxes, student loan repayments and rising costs has led to people under 30 feeling like a pack horse generation, saddled with debt and few opportunities to build wealth. Is this budget going to go anywhere to tackling that intergenerational fairness? Mm.
So there are a few things in here, I think, that are aimed at young people, and we should talk about them. There's 5 million for libraries and secondary schools in England, 18 million to improve playgrounds, funding to make the training for under 25 apprenticeships free for small and medium-sized businesses. There's the youth guarantee funding. And of course, there's the raising of minimum wage as well. But all of this is set in a backdrop of the fact that young people already face high taxes, as you say, student loan repayments, rising rents, stagnant wages. Nothing here massively shifts that burden. freezing income tax thresholds and adding new national insurance contributions on pensions will disproportionately fall on under 40s. Because if you're under 40, the one meaningful incentive you had to save into a pension was probably your salary sacrifice scheme. And now scrapping that is going to be a major disincentive. And of course, the other fact is older homeowners who've benefited from decades of rising property wealth aren't really touched by this. I mean, we have the mansion tax, but it's quite a small proportion actually of properties. We don't have any kind of radical changes to the tax system that would see the taxing of assets over income. And as we say, this is a budget that mostly gets that $26 billion from work.
Yeah.
So ultimately, if you're talking about the real systemic issues that are affecting younger people in this country, nothing here shifts the dial.
Can I also say that, just to add to that, there's been changes to the savings system. So the cash ISA allowance has now changed. So it previously was £20,000. That's now cut to £12,000. You can still, however, have £20,000 in an ISA. It's just £8,000 of that has to go on shares. So the premise of that is that Rachel Reeves is trying to get people to invest in Britain, because that £8,000 investment is only protected from taxation if it goes into companies that are working and investing in Britain. So there are provisions in there. Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert who's been, you know, doing his usual blow-by-blow analysis, is really genuinely brilliant. He has pointed out that this ISA change will not apply to over-65s, who will keep the £20,000 cash ISA limit. That's, again, going to play into this idea that, along with the fact that they haven't touched the triple lock on the pensions, is going to play into this kind of intergenerational warfare a bit, isn't it, Zoe?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are a few things in here that, if you're a young person, you're going to be looking at and thinking, oh, I think that might impact me, it might impact my savings, it might impact my pension. Does that mean I'm going to take home less money in my paycheck? And these are all things that, you know, when you're talking about pension contributions as well, we know we're already kicking quite a big, scary can down the road with that.
Yeah.
So anything that is sort of disincentivizing people or making people worry about their pensions, I think is not particularly helpful. I think one thing that maybe is good and will be helpful, but we'll have slightly missed kind of our generation, is the government is now planning...
Thank you for including us in your generation, Zoe.
Of course. Well, we're all missing from this particular legislative change. The government is now going to make, I believe, financial education compulsory in schools, which will help with people understanding things like savings and pensions, because I'm here talking about it as a political journalist and I'm like, I don't know, it sounds bad, you know? I don't think this is going to be good for me. So hopefully the new generation of political journalists will tell you exactly what that means.
Is there an argument that they shouldn't do that because they're being taught exactly how fucked they are?
Yeah, actually, maybe that was why we were never taught. Knowledge is power, guys. So there we are. But yeah, absolutely. I think there are things that are fundamentally huge issues for young people. And I don't think the budget does anywhere near enough to deal with those issues. As I said, I think this is a bit kind of a sticking plaster budget. It's dealing with political issues. It isn't radically touching much.
Well, let's move on to those political issues. But just before we do that, when it comes to with the raising of the minimum wage, the Resolution Foundation, so, you know, think tank that we talk about a lot on the show, they do a lot of work in inequality. The Resolution Foundation has said that minimum wage hikes risk causing more harm than good, as they risk deterring firms from hiring younger workers. Now, a number of young people not in education, employment or training is poised to hit 1 million for the first time since 2012. So what do you make of that as an argument?
I mean, I don't want to dismiss what the Resolution Foundation says, because, you know, they do a lot of good work on this. And I think there's often you do get a lot of concern over minimum wage hikes. We've always heard that from businesses. But I think when the Resolution Foundation is making a point, we do have to listen and understand the nuance.
Yeah.
I think what they're pointing out is there is a real economic tension here. If a minimum wage rises faster than productivity, of course, that can make employers cautious about hiring inexperienced young people. And the UK does have very weak employer investment in training. So firms who are already struggling sometimes just won't take a chance on someone who needs development. But of course, that's only one part of the picture. And I think blaming the minimum wage can become a distraction. It helps young people stay in work and escape poverty. What we actually need to look at are the real drivers of youth disengagement, like a collapse in apprenticeships, which the budget is trying to go some way to rectifying, cuts to further education colleges, the stagnating economy that's creating fewer entry-level jobs. I mean, we've all read the horrible headlines about how AI is removing so many graduate and entry-level jobs from the market. And of course, poor mental health amongst young people. So it could be one driver, but I think ultimately there are so many other things, again, we need to look at that is preventing young people from getting into work than focusing on something that, once they're in work, would help them stay out of poverty.
Right.
So let's go back to this political crisis. Everyone's been talking about the budget as make or break for Starmer and Reeves. The Prime Minister is under siege from his own party. So Labour MP Clive Lewis has said he would step down to allow Mayor Andy Burnham the chance to be Labour leader. He wouldn't be able to be unless he was an MP. And Labour MP Nadia Whittam has joined calls for Starmer to go. What do you think? Is this enough to settle these upcoming leadership struggles?
I think it removes the budget as a flashpoint, right? The markets have reacted fairly well to this. You know, our overlords are best pleased with us. So that's great. I think there's enough in there. I think the two-child benefit cap, I hate to frame it as a clever political move because we just said for loads of reasons it isn't. Yeah. But in terms of having a bunch of Labour MPs across the spectrum who are irate and nervous and are saying, we're not being Labour enough. And that's part, you know, that's the major issue here. I think that helps relieve some of that. There's other kind of progressive elements in here. You know, you can talk about the mansion tax, gambling tax as well, which would raise more than 1 billion, the freezing of Russian assets, and then the little things like £18 million for playgrounds, the rail freeze. You know, there's enough in there, I think, that Labour MPs will feel this is sufficiently Labour-y enough, progressive enough. But it's not enough to deal with all the other things that are happening, you know, prisons overcrowding, NHS waiting lists, the crisis in SEND and in schools, you know, all these things that are happening. So all you're doing really is, with this budget, prolonging the pain. It isn't enough to fundamentally change the economic or political context. You know, reform is on the rise. Labour MPs are still worried about their seats. I think it buys them more time. I think it might bring them together because there's some good stuff in there they can rally around. But I don't think it's going to stop people from saying that Keir Starmer is going to be gone before the next election, no.
In terms of the way that it handled the various opposition parties, I mean, there was a clear reference to the policies and the gifts that they're offering to the Welsh government as being an example of a Labour government talking to another Labour government. There were specific policy announcements for Scotland and Northern Ireland that came, in the case of Scotland, with a kicking for the SNP. There was a sort of pretty direct dig and a reference to his sort of hypnotherapist past at Zach Polanski in the Green Party. And there was an attempt to sort of bunch the Conservatives and the Reform Party into kind of one economic sort of bracket, which is people who just want to offer tax cuts, which will inevitably destroy public services. Do you think that Rachel Reeves has done enough with this to silence criticism from the left, from the Green Party, and from the right, from reform?
No.
Right. it's still that thing.
Basically,
about,
no.
About the story. I was sort of hoping that there would be a moment where what would rise to the top of this budget, or certainly what would rise to the top in the coming weeks, in the coming months, now that Labour are really feeling quite shook about the, you know, the green threat and what's going on with reform, that the vision, the ideology might start creeping out now.
It still feels very technocratic and managerial to me. You know, like if you talk about, for example, the cost of living measures, so energy bills, they said that scrapping this ecosystem and other legacy costs would cut about £150 from the average energy bill. And then the rail fare freeze. Okay, but it really is a drop in the ocean to the economic hardship people are dealing with.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a rail fare freeze, voters won't thank you for stopping rail fares from going up more. They'll say my rail fare is still too high. Yeah, it needs to be cut. So I don't think that they can massively prove that they are helping with the cost of living. And we know the cost of living is the major driver to people from departing from the centre ground. I think if you're talking about the Tories and reform, the parties that want the big tax cuts, they're just going to lead with £26 billion of tax rises and public spending is going up. And then you're going to get the Greens and those on the left saying, we should have gone way more. Why are we only doing mansion tax and not a complete reform of the council tax system, which is regressive? Why are we praising ending the two-child benefit cap, but they're still going to push ahead with some kind of reform to the welfare system that is undoubtedly going to be punitive? So I think, no, they haven't done enough, basically.
So just from a purely political perspective, your appraisal is still bad, but no worse.
Still bad, but they might have bought themselves a little bit of time internally with the party. I mean, that is, you know, it's the best I can give you, Nish. I'm sorry.
Zoe, thank you so much for joining us on PodSafe the UK.
Now, dear listeners, this is a reminder that we're going to be running a New Year mailbag special where we answer all your questions. That is right. any and all of your questions. You might, for instance, be interested to know if Coco Khan has really kicked her ChatGPT habit. I'll answer that now. She hasn't. And she used it this week for some medical advice, which is objectively insane.
How many times are you going to use this show as a form of bullying to me?
How
long is this going to go on?
Until you stop using ChatGPT, I will not stop in this agenda.
Perhaps you want to know what it's like being in a parasocial relationship with Nish. Sorry.
Bad. It's bad.
It's really weird because Nish is actually famous, even though he is in denial about it. And so when I talk to Nish about his life, he'll tell me about what pizza he ate or what film he's going to see. And then I'll turn on the fucking TV and he'll be on TV talking to Ian Hislop. And I just think, I just don't know why you wouldn't have mentioned that in our chat yesterday.
I'm more interested in discussing the films I'm seeing and the pizza I'm eating.
Anyway, look, political questions are also very welcome in our mailbag special.
Now, after the break, we go back to the budget. Rachel Reeves has said that it's progressive, but we're going to be speaking to the director of Tax Justice UK about what it actually does to address wealth inequality in this country. Our chat with Faiza Shaheen is coming up next. Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Calm.
If anyone else is feeling like this year has flown by too fast and you're having that where did the time go anxiety, well, then you should think about Calm. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and it's here to help you feel better.
If you're feeling like you could use some help and support navigating life's ups and downs, get the relief you need with Calm sessions like guided meditations to help you work through anxiety and stress, boost your focus, build healthier habits, and take better care of your physical health.
Something that I've been finding really useful are the sleep stories, sleep meditations, calming music for the insomniacs out there like me. They can really help you drift off to something a bit more restful.
Grounding exercises can help you reset and relax when you're feeling overwhelmed. And there are expert-led talks to help you handle grief, improve self-esteem, improve relationships, and more.
And there's an app. So the Calm app puts the tools you need right in your pocket. So stress and anxiety relief is always within.
Calm has over 2 million five-star reviews and can help you stress less, sleep more, and live mindfully.
Calm your mind and change your life. Calm has an exclusive offer just for listeners of our show. So you can get 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/PSTUK. This is amazing value, guys.
Go to Calm, that's calm.com/PSTUK for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. calm.com/PSTUK and tell Calm you heard about them from me.
Rachel Reeves has insisted that this is a Labour budget and promised to get a grip on the cost of living, especially for lower earners. But what does it actually do to tackle inequality?
Here to break it down for us is economist and self-proclaimed inequality geek, Dr. Faiza Shaheen. Faiza left the Labour Party last year after she was blocked from standing for a seat in Chingford and Woodford Green and is now the director of Tax Justice UK, a non-profit campaigning for a fairer tax system. Faiza, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So what did you make of the budget?
To be honest, I'm pretty underwhelmed. I think a lot of us were hoping to see much more on inequality and wealth in particular. And we want to see that because wealth has been growing so much for those at the very top. And meanwhile, income has barely risen at all since 2008. And the biggest thing that was announced today, or at least the revenue that will be raised, is coming from this freeze in personal tax thresholds. That means income taxes and national insurance contributions, which basically drags a lot more people into paying higher taxes, but in general means that people will be paying higher taxes. And I just think that's a huge contradiction between what we're hearing on the rhetoric from this government, that is essentially they're doing something about cost of living. Because whilst there are measures in this budget on that side, they could almost be cancelled out by this, or maybe more than cancelled out.
Everybody sort of generally agrees that if we want public spending to increase, we need to increase the money going into the Treasury. What would Tax Justice UK have liked to see those increases look like, if not a freezing of the income tax thresholds?
Yeah, so even where they have done something on wealth, so for instance, the mansion tax, that's going to raise about 400 million, which is nothing when you compare it to, say, equalising income with capital gains tax, which would raise around 8 billion, 8 to 10 billion. A wealth tax, which is something that a lot of people are talking about, even taking into account that some people will find ways to avoid it, is still £24 billion a year. And what we didn't see in today's budget is that sense of scale of change. Like, I really got this sense that they're trying to muddle through, right? They've got their political drama. They're trying to keep their jobs. They don't want to upset the bond markets. They don't want to, like, make anyone say this is absolutely wrong. And so they've kind of just done enough to sort of hang in there, and they haven't announced anything bold. And this just doesn't give us a sense of ambition for this country.
So with the mansion tax, and that's what people are billing it as, a mansion tax. When you say that, of course, it conjures up an image of the ultra wealthy, right? A mansion. So do you think Labour are going to say that that is a wealth tax, that they are not scared of taxing those with deep pockets? Or I'm trying to work out if we have to give them credit where credit's due, that this is a big deal, or if this is just a move to appear braver than they are.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite cosmetic in when you, like I said, if you look at the amount of money that it raises, it doesn't raise as much if they had taken some other steps. So one of the things that we were really hoping to see, for instance, was an exit tax, which would have raised a few billion more than this. And it seems as though, as what we're from what we're hearing from both the officials we know within government and the Treasury, and from others in similar positions to us that try and lobby government to do more progressive things, is that they were lobbied very heavily by the city, by the super rich, to not do this. There were other things trailed as well, new NIC contributions and profits from partnerships. We know that the big four accountancy firms pushed really hard on that. So we know that they were lobbied hard on dropping some of the things that would have really made the big difference on taxing wealth more. The mansion tax, yeah, I mean, look, it's better to have it than not to have it. But one of the things they're really going to come up against is that our housing stock has not been valued since 1991. So we're like on old, very old valuation. So it's a really, it's a system that's really complex and just incorrect. And now they're saying they're just going to revalue the top end, which is notoriously more difficult to do than like a normal house in a terrace street. And so they're also kind of walking into this bureaucratic nightmare. It's puzzling, to be honest, that they would choose this. And it does say something about who they're listening to. I mean, I know that they were thinking about some of these things until they were lobbied. So I guess it's also for us to lobby them harder from our point of view.
Faiza, can I just get you to define what an exit tax is?
It's basically saying, well, when you leave this country and you sell your assets, or you try and move your assets and some of your money to different parts of the world, that you will have to pay some kind of exit tax. Because actually, it's just saying you made your money in this country, used British infrastructure, British workers. Off the back of that, you owe a tax bill to this country. And actually, most other rich countries, including the US, have something like this in place. So it is disappointing to not get things like that.
For a really long time, people have been saying, on this podcast included, that we don't know what the Starmer project is. And I don't think anyone would look at this budget and necessarily say, okay, well, a philosophy has emerged to the top. But could it be that perhaps they are tinkering around the edges because they're testing things out? They want to see what might be popular. For example, this mansion tax. Could it be the start of something bigger?
I think we could, yeah, maybe be hopeful for that. I didn't get the sense from that, from the conversations that we've been having. One really good thing is that they've got rid of the two-child benefit cap. And I think had people not lobbied quite hard, then that wouldn't have happened. And this part, I feel mixed about it, because on the one hand, I'm like, finally, this will actually make a big difference for people on low incomes. But then it's a Labour government. Like, I would have thought that they would do that straight away. So the fact that we've had to work so hard and lobby so hard to make that happen, it's a mixed situation. But I didn't get a strong sense, and I was talking to other economists on the left, we didn't get a strong sense of a vision again, or where growth is going to come from. And they are betting on growth because they're not raising enough money to really turn around 14 years of austerity. They're just not. So they are hoping still that over the next year or couple of years, growth emerges, and they would need that to be higher than the kind of 1.5% average that they're that is being predicted right now, they'll need that to be higher so they can get higher tax receipts and then start spending more towards the end of this parliament. So it's kind of an old political trick that we'll just hold back for now and then hopefully we'll have more money towards the end and we'll show we've spent all this money. But I just think that's a huge risk to take.
What about cost of living? So the budget was pegged as being, you know, something that was going to address that. But Rachel Reeves announced that rail fares will be frozen and that they're going to take £150 off energy bills in April by cutting the energy company obligation scheme. Now, if you go back to the last couple of episodes of the show, we've discussed at length the environmental implications of that. So there's probably not much more for us to say on that particular issue. But just in terms purely of cost of living, do you think that this goes far enough, Fizer?
Well, it's good that they're listening on cost of living finally. But again, it's underwhelming because you have to think, okay, rail fares are so high in this country already, especially when compared to comparable countries. And it's just a freeze. So it's not like people are going to see a reduction in the costs. They're just not going to see a massive increase like they used to see in every year. And then alongside that, you have, yeah, energy bills. Again, that's really great. But you have other ways in which energy bills are going to go up next year. There's nothing on, say, council tax bills, which are expected to go up again in April. And you've got this personal income tax thresholds frozen. So it kind of gets cancelled out. So it's not, again, it's not really clear that it's people are going to feel like markedly better off. It's just a bit piecemeal. And next year, local elections in May, are people going to feel any better off under a Labour government? I don't see that. And so they will still take that political hammering. So they've just sort of kicked the can down the road on that front.
I keep coming back to this problem that we keep discussing on the show about this government not having a big idea or a philosophy. And you know, it could be a philosophy that I don't necessarily agree with or doesn't go far enough. But what is it? Just on the subject of that, what would you have liked to have seen?
I mean, just in terms of the tax side, we would have absolutely have liked to have seen the equalisation on capital gains. That would finally mean that people earning their money from sort of going out day to day, income, wages, you get your payslip, are getting the same amount, are taxed at the same level as people that are getting it from dividends and property and the rest of it. And so that would have been a really positive move in terms of tax justice, and would have loved to see an announcement and more resources to start building us towards a wealth tax, because we do need a bit more information on the rich. We actually have a very poor handle of how much money the very rich have in this country. Just a really clear story about, we hear you working people in this country that say we've been squeezed year after year and we're struggling. And so we are going to shift this tax contribution towards those people that have, you know, a huge amounts of assets at the very top. You know, the billionaires have 650 billion worth of money. I mean, that's just insane. We can't even like comprehend how much money that is, right? And so, you know, and we always ask for this 2% rate on over 10 million. Again, 10 million pounds. Can you imagine? Anything under 10 million, you don't get charged on. So, you know, these are really not big things to ask. I would have loved to have seen that. And I would have loved to see more serious plans on how they're going to do things like have a free universal childcare system, for instance. It just is just so small in comparison. And like you say, yeah, the energy companies, okay, yeah, people need a reprieve, but there needs to be something much more harder done on companies that are making so much money. And I think the thing that I know from being in the Labour Party and listening to some of the leadership before they came into government is also that, yeah, they are timid around some of these things. They do want to be seen as pro-business. So that's why they get sort of stuck and end up not pleasing anyone and not doing the bold things.
You've criticised its lack of ambition. What are the things that you're pleased with in terms of what's been announced?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, as someone that spent part of my childhood on benefits and was one of three, I mean, I'm absolutely delighted for those families. So yeah, the end of the two-child benefit cap feels really important and significant, I guess, for us. And this is, you know, you can't just be like negative about things. You have to think, okay, where do we go from here? Like the mansion tax gives us an opportunity to talk about how the council tax system in general needs to be reformed. And I mean, it's so outdated and there's all kinds of weird anomalies. Like we just started talking about it in the office and like, I've got a two-bedroom place, someone else got a two-bedroom place, even though we're both in London, we're in different local authorities, therefore we pay different amounts, even though we're in the same band. It just makes no sense. So this is an opportunity to say, okay, you've taken this one step, this is actually how you could solve it. So I think there's some things that just give, for people like me that work to change the system, ultimately to work for working class and middle class people in this country, it gives us an in to say, okay, you've done this, this is what we could do next.
Well, speaking of wealth taxes, they have come under fire recently, not just from the usual suspects, I would add, but also people on the left. And we wanted to put some of those arguments to you as tax justice. So Aditya Chakraborty wrote in The Guardian last week that it was a pantomime. It doesn't really tackle the fundamentals. What do you say to this?
Yeah, I've been meaning to text Aditya about this and just be like, thank you for this article. None of us advocate that this is somehow going to solve everything. But what we do say is that we need to start taking wealth concentration at the very top much more seriously. And not just as a money raising thing, but as a point about how inequality is really affecting this country. We know that it's the same sort of very rich people that are, for instance, funding reform and the Tories and division in our country. We know that it's undermining the economy to grow overall just because of the way it's balancing our economy towards the very, very rich and their assets. And so 2% wealth tax is a way to just say, okay, look, now we're going to, one, measure how rich the rich are, do something to start taxing them and just make this much more of a mainstream economic and social policy position. So, yeah, I mean, I agree that it's not everything, but we need to start somewhere. And it has really opened up the conversation. Like, I just saw someone on the bus who I've known for a while, a couple of days ago, and he's a teacher. And he said one of his politics students had brought it up and then they had a whole debate on it. Like, that just doesn't happen on, say, even like capital gains. Like, people just don't know what that means. So, you know, we have to be honest about the fact that you also have to get the public behind something. And a wealth tax is a really helpful policy in that people understand it. And it just gives us a sense of what we could be doing instead in a way that the public can support and get behind.
Your sort of task now, I guess, in terms of Tax Justice UK is to continue the lobbying to turn this budget into a starting point for a conversation rather than a kind of silver bullet, right?
We were never going to get everything that we wanted, and there's always more to fight for. And also, really importantly, for people out there that just feel like, oh, what's the point? They need to feel like, okay, yeah, we are getting bits and pieces and we do want to keep fighting this fight to make sure that when it comes to the next election or even May, I mean, May is such an important time because local elections, if Labour does really badly, which I think many people expect them to, lose loads of seats to the Greens and Reform, and they're sort of hunting for ideas, then that's a really opportune time for us to say, look, take wealth far more seriously and talk about wealth tax. You know, that's a kind of big idea that someone like Andy Burnham could come in with. So it's all to play for.
Thaisa, thank you so much for joining us on PodSave the UK. After the break, what's got Nigel Farage on the back foot, and have your party finally put the feuding behind them?
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Aura Frames.
It's Christmas time. It's gift-giving season. You're always at this point in the year thinking about what you're going to buy your parents or your grandparents. You want to give them a good gift that can also show a meaningful connection, especially if you have family that's far away from you in a different country. Aura Frames are the ideal Christmas gift.
And so there's loads of great qualities about Aura Frames. You can preload the photos before it's sent out. So you can send someone a frame and it already has pictures of your beautiful beaming face. You can personalize your gifts. You can add a message. It's really easy to share photos and to share videos. Actually, for the holidays, if you're thinking about wrapping it, well, there's a gift box included. And there's also a tagline that I have to read out, which is, you can't wrap togetherness, but you can frame it.
Nice.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on. For a limited time, visit AuraFrames.com and get $45 off Aura's best-selling Carver mat frames. They've been named the number one by Wirecutter, and you can use promo code PSUK at checkout.
That's AuraFrames, AuraFrames.com, and the promo code is PSUK. This exclusive Black Friday Cyber Monday deal is their best of the year, so order now before it ends. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout.
Terms and conditions apply. Now, a lot of shit never seems to stick to Nigel Farage, but finally, he looked a little bit rattled this week.
Yes, first there's the awkward fact that Reform's former leader in Wales, Nathan Gill, was jailed for 10 years for taking bribes from Russia while he was a UKIP member of the European Parliament. There was lots of condemnation of Gill from Farage, but no commitment to investigating links between Reform and Russia. Because as Farage put it, I am not a police force. First of all, thank God. That's the last thing we need is Nigel Farage being the head of his own private militia. But also, not really a good enough excuse it's an extraordinary piece of obfuscation.
Well, unsurprisingly, Keir Starmer had a field day with this during his statement about Ukraine in the Commons. Interestingly, Farage chose not to be there when Starmer told MPs, you can't be pro-Putin and pro-Ukraine. You have to choose between the two, and reform is pro-Putin.
So in addition to this, there was a really old story that has also put Nigel Farage even further on the back foot. There are allegations that the teenage Farage racially abused non-white and Jewish pupils in his school. Now, these allegations have actually been around for more than a decade, but The Guardian has once again been digging away at them. But when the BBC Wales political editor tackled Farage this week, the wheels started to come off.
The question is, did you ever racially abuse fellow pupils in school? No. You've caveated it with a hurtful way.
Not with intent.
What do you mean not with intent? I don't understand what you mean by not with intent. What does that mean?
You wouldn't do.
But what does that mean?
No.
No what?
No. I have never directly really tried to go and hurt anybody.
You're opening the door there to perhaps you did it without meaning to offend.
Have I said things 50 years ago that you could interpret as being banter in a playground, that you could interpret in the modern light of day in some sort of way, yes. But isn't it funny?
Okay, so you did say stuff to these people then?
I never directly racially abused anybody, no.
Now, we discussed this briefly on the pod last week, but that interview on Monday has really escalated the story. Reform said the claims were without foundation and an attempt to smear Farage. But hearing Farage's interview, ex-pupils then went on to the BBC to challenge his account.
One Jewish former classmate said, one of the most vivid memories of my school life is Farage repeatedly coming up to me and, knowing I was Jewish, saying Hitler was right and gas him. And that was frequently followed by a kind of imitating the sound of escaping gas.
After that, Nigel Farage doubled down, telling GB News, I categorically deny saying those things to that one individual. And frankly, for The Guardian and the BBC to be going back just shy of half a century to come out with this stuff shows how desperate they are.
I mean, it's also worth pointing out, just because I think it is something that doesn't necessarily tally with Farage's public image as a man of the people. The school in question is a very exclusive private school, Dulwich College, mm-hmm. In South London. But what I would say is Farage has had a very easy ride in the British press. But I would say this is what it looks like when he's faced with direct and tough questions, right?
Yeah, I think the thing that is so surprising is that this is the story that's cut through, when actually there will be some who hear his argument that is, you know, it was over half a century ago, I was a teenager, I've always been a provocateur, you know, whatever, and we'll accept that. Whereas we could just look at things that he's done as an adult man and the far right parties, let's be honest, Nazi leaders and characters that he has liaised with. We don't need to go back to what happened in the playground.
On the Russia front, clearly Starmer thinks there's mileage in it. Also, the Lib Dem leader Ed Davey said that Farage was previously paid to be on Russian President Vladimir Putin's TV channel Russia Today and has asked, we must all ask, where do his loyalties really lie? Meanwhile, Mike Katz, the Labour peer and former Jewish Labour movement chair, said Farage is essentially arguing you can racially abuse people without it being hurtful and insulting, while Liberal Democrat MP for Eastbourne, Josh Babarinde, christened him No Answers Nigel. Listen, outside of his school career, Farage has a history of indulging in conspiracy theories that are either directly racist or racist at their core. The sort of supposedly responsible right in Britain and America have consistently indulged in the cultural Marxism conspiracy theory. And cultural Marxism is a phrase that was actually invented by the Nazis in Germany in the 1930s. And it was a specific way of attacking the Jewish intelligentsia in the country. And I'm sort of amazed by how frequently I've heard it used in the last 10 years. We've talked about it on this show, with Suella Braverman. I'm amazed at how often it's used by supposedly reasonable conservative politicians or centre-right conservative politicians. Also, Nigel Farage did address the AfD, which is the German far-right party. So what I'm saying is, the problem that he has, I think, with these allegations about things he said as a school child is too much of his adult behaviour means that when these allegations are made, it's not a huge leap for them to be believed.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the adult that addresses the AfD and indulges in, you know, conspiratorial thinking, which is very frequently comes out of anti-Semitic global movements, it's not a very big leap.
Right, exactly.
It's like Trump and the Epstein files. You know, we don't know if he's in them or what he's named as doing. But when it comes out, no one's going to be like, what?
Well, is that
Donald Trump?
Exactly. And so, you know, it's hard for me to put myself in the mind of a big reform lover. But I would imagine that what they rank in terms of what they like about Nigel Farage, the idea that he's inclusive with his language is probably pretty low. You know, we're applying progressive standards to a man whose entire brand is eschewing that. So will any of it make a dent on him? I don't know. If we want to look at racist stuff that Nigel Farage has done, we don't need to go back to his teenage years. There's stuff that he's done right now, is doing right now. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier about his liaising with far-right parties. What I was referring to there was when he was in the European Parliament, he was working very closely with the Swedish Democrats, which was founded by someone from the SS.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't need to tie ourselves in knots about his teenage extremism.
Yeah.
That said, though, it has been good to watch him fall over himself and to look rattled about this question, which he has sidestepped in for far too long, which is, you're a racist, though, aren't you, Nige? You are, though, aren't you? Like, it's about time someone pressed him on it, even if he's going to keep sidestepping.
So, look, last week we checked in on the chaotic start that's engulfed your party over the last few months. But just a few days before their conference is due to happen, there might be a bit of peace in the air. We should say that there was another resignation of one of the steering committee last week. But listen, once you're on that drama train, it can be hard to get off it.
Yeah. So some of you reached out to me after my small rant last week where I talked about how everything that's happening with your party isn't really good enough. Well, it seems like maybe they actually agree.
Yeah, so it certainly struck a chord with the listeners, I believe, you saying that it wasn't good enough.
Exasperation often does. Both Zara Sultana and Jeremy Corbyn have made public apologies in the last few days. Here's a clip of Corbyn speaking to the New Statesman.
I'm sorry if you are at all disappointed. I hope, however, your wish and your determination to have a democratic, serious left voice that will challenge reform, that will challenge austerity, challenge the Tories and so on, will be there.
So that video dropped on Tuesday and Zara Sultana issued a statement on Monday saying that the Your Party founding process has been challenging, to say the least. I know many members are feeling frustrated and disillusioned, but the need for this party has not disappeared. The opportunity to reshape our society has not been foreclosed by a run of regrettable media coverage. Debate and disagreement are part of any healthy political project, but they must be conducted in a respectful manner. It concluded by saying, let's make this the moment we get the party back on track.
The other big Your Party news is connected, I think, to this because it seems designed to limit the drama going forward. So the party has ruled out the co-leadership model originally floated that might have seen Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana leading the new party together. Instead, they're putting to their membership the choice between single leadership or collective leadership, which Your Party describes as a model where they would be collectively led by ordinary members elected to the Central Executive Committee, with the chair, vice chair and spokesperson in particular serving as the public political leadership. That would mean that they wouldn't necessarily need to be MPs or publicly elected people in order to be on a kind of steering committee for Your Party. So Coco, having expressed exasperation last week, how do you feel this week?
I'm glad that there's been contrition and I'm glad that they have understood that for a lot of people, it's really disappointing and it's heart-wrenching and heartbreaking and that there's a lot of emotions pinned to this, you know, and they understand that, you know, that it's not just an intellectual exercise, but one of, you know, heart and soul for so many people. So I'm glad to see that. I'm not sure what I feel about this ruling out the co-leadership model. I wonder if all the people that donated thought there might be a co-leadership model.
Right.
I don't know necessarily if ruling it out is fair. Should it not have been one of the options in terms of, I thought everything was going to be run by committee and everything was going to be
There's still that option for people to have it. What does seem to have been taken off the table is the idea that this will be led by two people. I think the thing that they're trying to posit is this idea of a kind of executive committee.
But is that because the two people that everyone had in mind don't want to do it? Is that why?
Listen, it's hard to escape the sense that that's what's going on.
Okay. Look, it's their conference this weekend, right?
Yes.
So let's see. Perhaps there will be headlines coming out of that really rouses people like us who have been, you know, quietly watching, but maybe feeling a little bit disappointed. We shall see. But at the moment, I'm just not feeling great about it.
If you want more details on what the membership is actually going to be voting for at your party's conference this weekend, we've dropped a link to their founding documents in our show notes. I think we will also have a name for this party, which is probably also pretty useful for them. Just as they were trying to put all the drama behind them, we should mention that Zach Polanski stirred the pot by inviting Zara Sultana to join the Greens. So
Zach Polanski is getting very good at stirring the pot. You have to give it to him.
Finally, we should say there has been a sort of a cherry on the cake for the good news for one of your party's founding members. Jeremy Corbyn's panto appearance has received rave reviews. So apparently he enters with, "It's me, the wizard," and then says, "I've been very busy planning a party, a new party. It's harder than it sounds." He to be clear, I think we've talked about this on the show before. He's making an appearance. He's filmed an appearance that is played in as part of the panto that's playing at the Pleasance Islington at the moment. And I did a benefit gig at the Pleasance this week. It's just very funny because, you know, I'm used to going into venues and seeing pictures of other comedians on there. I'm less used to going in and seeing a picture of Jeremy Corbyn on a venue that I'm about to do stand-up comedy in.
There's always this thing where people say to MPs, "Well, when this vote was going on, where were you? You were on holiday. What was Jeremy Corbyn doing?" It's me, the wizard.
Well, he was appearing by video.
No,
you know,
okay,
he's on the verge
of... I'm here for it. His support for the arts, we respect it.
He's on the verge of sort of ABBA voyaging himself. I think that that's the sort of thing we should encourage more of our politicians to do, is to make appearances by video, like harness some of that hologram technology and do some of the more pointless events that MPs are required to
participate in. I think you should be very careful what you wish for, given all your long-standing feelings about Cuban Pete, a.k.a. Ed Balls. You should be really think closely about whether you want to see more politicians partaking in, you know...
I'm sort of fine with them doing it by hologram. Also, okay. Ed Balls is free to... Cuban Pete is free to do as he pleases now. He's a member of the media. He's free to act as he pleases. If you live in or around London, I can't even plug one of them. I'm doing about 75 benefits in the next month and a half. You can find the details of them as part of my brand of tediously left-wing comedian. Even I'm sick of it now. I keep turning up on stage at benefit gigs and you can see the audience go, "Jeez, again? Don't you have a social life?"
And I can answer that. And the answer is no. Does not have a social. So that's it. Thank you for listening to. But that was a dig at you for outing me about ChatGPT.
I will never stop outing you about ChatGPT.
Like I said, it wasn't for medical advice. It was understanding a paper, okay? As a second reference. Another reminder, please, to send us your questions for our mailbag episode.
Definitely ask. ChatGPT is Coco's Dulwich School Days racism. It's got her absolutely rattled. Normally, she's unflappable and composed. Now she is.
You wouldn't understand, would you? You would not understand, would you?
She's not a police force. Yeah. How could she police her own behaviour over the course of a week?
Oh God. Please don't forget to follow at PodSaveTheUK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter and Blue Sky. Weird pleading there, wasn't it?
Yeah, please. It does actually say that on the script. I don't know why you've added a please. Please.
I'm just desperate for love because I know I'm going to get outcasts of all this ChatGPT business. Pod Save the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to producers James Tyndale and May Robson.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Louise Cotton and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.